Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. More than six centuries have passed since the reformer John Wycliffe and his followers completed the first translation of the Bible into English. Wycliffe, whose attacks on church doctrine led to his condemnation as a heretic, died after suffering a stroke in 1384. But controversy over his work persisted. 4 decades after his death, the Pope ordered Wycliffe's remains dug up and burned. Today, while not a crime, biblical translation in some ways remains controversial. Tonight, we hear a lecture by Dr. Everett Fox, director of the program in Jewish Studies at Clark University and a former professor at Boston University. Dr. Fox is author of Give Us a King, a new translation of the Book of Samuel, and translator of The Five Books of Moses. In a speech entitled Translating the Bible Again, Dr. Fox addresses some of the difficulties in translating biblical texts. He spoke recently at Boston University as part of the University Professors Program 2004 Literary Translation Seminar Series. Dr. Fox.
Thanks very much. I'm very happy to be here. It's been a long time since I taught at BU. But it's nice to be back in a context where people are not merely reading the Bible or not merely studying literature, but are studying translation. I had occasion to speak a number of years ago at a conference of literary translators that took place at the University of Indiana. And when I was preparing to address them, it struck me that this was a group that was on the front lines, people translating Portuguese poetry, material from ancient languages, material from obscure modern languages, and who really did not get the acclaim that they deserve. People who are wrestling with difficult problems of language, transmission of culture from one world to another. And so anybody who works in the field, I think, knows that there are battles to be fought, but they are not trivial battles. They're battles that involve the soul of literature and battles that involve inevitable loss and sometimes gain. What I'd like to share with you today is a few thoughts and one text, one larger text, on the book that is translated more than any other. A number of years ago, when I was trying to get financial support for my work, people encouraged me to apply to the National Endowment for the Humanities. And I never did it, partly because when I looked at their application material, they said they were particularly interested in the translation of texts that had never been worked on in English. And I felt a little silly applying in a context in which this had been done for a good 400 years and more. And so you probably know that there is a very long tradition, a long history of translation of the Bible into English. The great name that comes to mind, not the first, but the most important, William Tyndale. He is a great example to many of us, but also provides a word of caution, because in the mid-1530s, after completing his translation of the Five Books of Moses and various other parts of the Bible, Tyndale found himself standing on a platform tied to a large piece of wood with an executioner coming up behind him who strangled him and then burned him. That's one of the more merciful executions of the 16th century. But it is a cautionary note to translators. I hope to end up a little better than he did. My own way into this material was in many ways accidental, but it came really from two sources, and one was a long interest in music. And so you could say that, perhaps this is true of many translators, that you are prepared for your work by the sounds around you and by the natural structures of both human speech and of music itself. And over the years, there have been opera libretti and song texts that have interested me. I'll give you one example that maybe will be useful as we look at a biblical text. If anybody knows the great opera of Verdi, Otello, based, of course, on Shakespeare's Othello, libretto by Arrigo Boito. And in one scene, which is actually not in Shakespeare, but maybe a slight improvement, Iago, the villain, after his master leaves him, intones a bitter, I wouldn't call it aria, it's not very song-like, but it's a piece known as the Credo, in which he says, "I believe in a malevolent God." It's this horrifying, black, dark speech about evil. And he ends with the phrase, death and nothingness, and heaven is an ancient lie. Well, this is pretty strong stuff, even in the 19th century. La morte nulla, nothing. A minute later, he finishes, and Othello comes in, unsuspecting, and says to him, "What have you been doing?" Or, you know, "What's up? What are you doing?" And Iago turns to him and says, "Nulla, nothing. Oh, nothing." Examples like this really, really struck me in my musical thoughts. This lovely play between nothingness as the meaning of life and, "Oh, nothing, I'm just hanging around." And it's that kind of wordplay that you have to be really aware of when you deal with texts like the Bible, because especially an ancient text that is so aware of language and its potentialities, this is going on all the time, and I hope to show you some examples today. So music, musical structure, but also language related to music, is one thing that was very important for me. But the other thing is the history of translation itself, because I was lucky enough when I was an undergraduate at Brandeis to have studied with Nachum Glotzer, who also taught at BU at the end of his career. Glotzer, in turn, was the student of Martin Buber and Franz Rosenzweig, these two gentlemen who in the 20s translated a good portion of the Hebrew Bible into German. And when I encountered this translation my senior year, I was completely rattled by it, because I thought I knew the Bible pretty well in English. But I was not prepared for what this German translation did to it. For one thing, it was printed in lines that look like free verse. For another thing, all the names were transcribed not in the usual English or German forms, but in pretty close to a Hebrew pronunciation. And the language itself was just strange, all kinds of odd constructions, not the kind of German that most German speakers would be fully comfortable with. So this really intrigued me and led me back to the text, and that in essence led me back to the Hebrew text. And I began to see that I had been reading it without sound, that I hadn't been paying attention to the sound of the text, the puns, the plays on words, or even the rhythm of the text. And so slowly, in my own experience, I went back to the text and began to read it out loud, something you have to do slowly, the way you would if you were an actor rehearsing Shakespeare, even in the privacy of your own room. And gradually, over time, the rhythm of the text became clearer and clearer to me, and that led me to try, I was young and foolish, to attempt a chapter or two of the Bible in some kind of New English. Because what I realized from looking at the conventional translations, and there are many from the 50s on, they're all over the bookstores, conventional English translations have tried to make the Bible fluent, fluid, understandable, comfortable. That's not surprising, especially in a Christian context where there's the desire to spread the word of God. But I was interested in another direction, namely, how can we get back closer to the text itself? What is there about this text that needs to be transmitted? Sometimes it's obscurity. Sometimes there are difficult texts, for whatever reason, either difficult deliberately or difficult because a scribe had a bad day and we are left to try and figure out what went wrong. But in any event, this is not an easy text. But it is a text that is self-referential. that alludes to other stories, other passages, that plays off itself. And I became convinced after reading essays, especially by Buber, that in fact, if you paid attention to the language of the text and read slowly and listened to the rhythm and tried to sense, as you'll see in a moment, key words, that that was one entry into the text, one of many, but one which I thought had been neglected in translation. As I say, I was very young, so I didn't know any better. If I had it to do all over again, I might not have started out on this path, because it has its pitfalls and its difficulties. But I would have to say that, by and large, there are great rewards. As you probably know, many of you from doing some translation yourselves, either a book or a page, it's really the only way to get to know a text well. It's the difference between taking a music course where you study a piece and having to perform it and prepare it over months and months. It's a different kind of relationship. Now, Buber and Rosenzweig, in their work in German, produced something that looked different, sounded different than previous German translations. And it's something which is done partially typographically. When you write out something in verse-type lines, you begin to see structures in a text that you would not appreciate otherwise. And again, we live in a society which is very book-bound. At the same time, it's very media-conscious, but I'm sad to say that most of the rhetoric and poetry in the media seems to be connected to commercials and advertising various products and less on literature itself. But if one is conscientious, one can produce lines which even visually encourage one to read out loud. Let me give you a very brief example of that. The very beginning of the Bible. The Bible opens with a creation story, not from nothingness, but moment number two, at the beginning of God's creating of the heavens and the earth, and it goes on to say, famous line, God said, let there be light, and there was light. Now, that opening line, and indeed the opening paragraph, these are set out in a series of four occurrences of God and a verb. God said, God saw, God separated, God called. God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw the light, that it was good. God separated between the light and the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. Four lines, totally orderly. If you print them out that way, you begin to apprehend the structure of the whole chapter, which is obsessed with order. That's the main principle of creation. If, on the other hand, you write it out as a paragraph, God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated between the light and the darkness. You know, just a normal speech. Then you miss what seems to me to be the intent of the paragraph. And there are hundreds and thousands of examples of the same kind of structuring that goes on. The rhetoric becomes really the most important thing. Names, as I mentioned before, are extremely important in these texts. For one thing, they have meanings most of the time. These are not characters with accidental names. But sometimes the sound itself of a person's name can be important. In one of the really striking stories in the book of Samuel, King David has a son named Absalom, who is very much like David himself, and eventually he revolts against the father, drives him from Jerusalem, starts a civil war. Toward the end of that story, David has to fight back, but he commands his troops not to harm Absalom when they capture him, because he still has the soft spot in his heart for the boy. The troops don't fully follow his order. Joab, his general, eventually catches up with Absalom and, if not kills him, wounds him severely, leads to his death. In one of the most famous and wrenching moments in literature. The old David sits by the gate waiting for news of the battle. We know what's happened, but he doesn't yet. And when he finally finds out, he utters a terrible cry. Oh, my son, Absalom, 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 my son, would that I had died for you. Oh, my son, Absalom, Absalom, and so on. It's like everything else in the Bible, it's very useful to use these phrases as book titles. Now, you know, when you read that in English, oh, my son, Absalom, Absalom, you know, or my son, Absalom, my son, it has a certain resonance. But in Hebrew, it's constructed out of long vowels. So my son is Beni, son is Ben, and Beni is my son, and Absalom is Avshalom, ending in an O, a long vowel. So in Hebrew, instead of my son, Absalom, which has one kind of force, kind of a herky-jerky force, you get Beni, Beni, Avshalom, Avshalom, Beni, Beni, something that to me sounds a lot more like a natural grieving kind of rhythm. Now, you know, why did that happen? Is this just luck that language produces that? Maybe. But language adopts itself to the situation. Now I can never hear that phrase again, my son Absalom. Absalom, just it's an ugly-sounding name. And for some reason or other, it hasn't been used very much. I haven't seen that biblical name revived. Maybe people use it for pets, I don't know, but not so much for people. In any event, this is something that happens really very frequently. And we are led all the time to think about the rhythm and the sound of words. What I want to share with you as a text today is also from the book of Samuel. Very famous text, and it's a good example of how even when we know a text well or have heard of it, and even when the events are generally familiar, that going back to the text and trusting that a rereading will bring out new things, in fact, does produce a new way into the text. And the way is provided by what Buber wrote a great deal about. He called it the leading word approach, Leitwort. Very simply, a leading word is a word that is a key word or a theme word in a text. And in Buber's view, if it's repeated within a story or maybe even in a larger unit across a book, it has the effect of alerting the reader or the listener to an important theme or an important aspect of the text. He didn't like to go further than that. He was not always willing to pin down why a certain word would repeat numerous times. But I have found that when you look at many of these narrative texts, that this kind of approach is very helpful. It doesn't provide everything. You need the tools of archaeology and the tools of comparative language and etymology. But this is one way in that's not always carefully noticed. The context of this story is that it's a turning point in the entire book. Until this moment, King David had been first an obscure shepherd boy who became attached to court, became the court musician, soothing King Saul's shattered nerves. He went out and killed the giant Goliath, or the very tall Goliath, I should say. And along the way, simply everybody in sight fell in love with him. King Saul became enamored of him. Saul's daughter fell in love with him. Saul's son, the heir to the throne, more or less fell in love with him. The people fell in love with him. David had great success. Saul eventually was killed in battle. David came to the throne, put down the house of Saul, defeated Israel's enemies, had multiple wives and multiple heirs, captured Jerusalem, made it the capital, brought the Ark, the holy object of biblical Israel, to Jerusalem, unified the tribes, and on and on. So by the time we encounter him in 2 Samuel chapter 11, he is the king who has everything. There's literally nothing lacking in his life. and all should go smoothly. Several chapters before, God, through the prophet Nathan, has promised David that his dynasty will last forever and that his son will build a temple in Jerusalem. So really, all is well. And this, of course, in literature is always a prescription for disaster. And the Bible is no exception. Now, the story has its own natural drama. If we go back to 1611, to the most famous version of it in English, the King James Bible, it begins, "And it came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when the kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still at Jerusalem. And it came to pass at eventide, that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon," etc., etc. So, the tension is there from the very beginning, and we have a sense of what might happen. We find out who she is. Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? So she's married, but he sends for her anyway, and the inevitable happens. I doubt that the younger folks here have ever seen the classic motion picture David and Bathsheba made in the 50s, and they certainly wouldn't know who starred in it, but that's irrelevant. Susan Hayward, thank you, and King David was played by, recently died, Gregory Peck, yes. This is one of those classic Hollywood epics, biblical epics. I showed it to a group of students last year. They unanimously voted it the worst movie they'd ever seen. So it's very difficult to do this all in film. However, it has its own inherent drama. And we will see that the way in which this text works is that the drama is enhanced by the exact wording and by cross-references within the story. So I would like to read this for you, because you do need to get in the habit of hearing it out loud, and then we'll look at some of these aspects. The language here that I use, I would have to say, is not everyday language. It's a little bit elevated. At points, it's a little bit strange, but it's all designed to lead us back towards the original. And this is exactly what Buber and Rosenzweig wanted to do. Translation, they said, often is supposed to take you from the original language to the target language, to ferry you across, kind of gentle process. This is designed to do the opposite, to literally turn the boat around and send you back in the direction of the original. And be aware that this is not an English text. It's not a recent text. It's very old. We don't always know exactly how it works, but there's something about the language that is more powerful than simply writing it ourselves. Just a few words on the characters here. The names are all the Hebrew names, so it looks like David, but it's really David. Yoav is Joab the general. Bathsheba is Bathsheba. And the prophet Nathan is now transformed back to Nathan the prophet. And as I read this, what I would suggest to you is to listen for words that repeat. There are several of them. They're not just one or two. "Now it was at the turning of the year, at the time of kings going forth, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. They wrought ruin to the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, while David stayed in Jerusalem. Now it was around the time of sunset that David arose from his lying place and went for a walk upon the roof of the king's house. And he saw a woman washing herself from on the roof. The woman was exceedingly fair to look at. David sent and asked after the woman. They said, 'Isn't this Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, wife of Uriah the Hittite?'" Uriah, it turns out, is one of David's generals. He is not an obscure citizen. "David sent messengers and had her brought. She came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had just purified herself from her state of Tum'ah." That's a ritual impurity. Her period had ended. She had now purified herself. That means not so much that she was permitted to him, but that it was inevitable that she would get pregnant, because it's about 12 days after the beginning of the cycle, typically in the biblical counting. Then she returned to her house. Now, this is very different than the movie, as usual. I somehow recall in the movie Susan Hayward saying to Gregory Peck, "I've often watched you walking up there on the battlements and thought about how lonely it must be to be king," something like that. You know. So in typical Hollywood fashion, they implicated her. The Bible doesn't do that. And we'll have to ask ourselves why. So that's the end of scene one. The action takes place. The woman became pregnant. She sent and had it told to David. She said, "I am pregnant." So David sent word to Yoav, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Yoav sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David inquired after the well-being of Yoav, the well-being of the fighting people, and the well-being of the battle. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." That's the feet are washed typically as a sign of, you know, hospitality, and that's what you do when you get home. Uriah went out of the king's house, and after him went out a portion from the king. But Uriah lay down at the entrance to the king's house with all his lord's servants. He did not go down to his house. They told David, saying, "Uriah has not gone down to his house." David said to Uriah, "Isn't it from a long journey that you have come? Why haven't you gone down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The coffer," that's the holy ark, "the coffer and Israel and Judah are staying at Sukkot. My lord Yoav and my lord's servants are camping on the surface of the open field, and I should come into my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife. As you live, as your very being lives, were I to do this thing." David said to Uriah, "Stay here today as well. Tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah stayed in Jerusalem on that day. Now on the morrow, David had him called, and he ate and drank in his presence, and he made him intoxicated. And he went out in the evening to lie down in his lying place with his lord's servants, but to his house he did not go down. So it was in the morning that David wrote a letter to Yoav and sent it by the hand of Uriah. He wrote in the letter saying, "Put Uriah right at the front of the battle, the strongest point, and turn back behind him so that he is struck down and dies." So it was, when Yoav had observed the city, that he placed Uriah at the place where he knew that there were men of valor. And when the men of the city went out to do battle with Yoav, there fell some of the fighting people of David's servants, and there also died Uriah the Hittite. Then Yoav sent and had David told all the details about the battle. He charged the messenger, saying, "When you have finished reporting everything about the battle to the king, it will be, if the king's anger starts up and he says to you, 'Why did you draw near the city to do battle? Didn't you know that they would shoot down from on the wall?'" And now he makes a reference to something earlier in the Bible where a certain king was killed. "Who struck down Avimelech, son of Yerubboshet? Wasn't it a woman who threw down on him a riding millstone from on the wall, so that he died at Tevetz? For what reason did you approach the wall?" Then you are to say, "Also your servant Uriah the Hittite died." The messenger went off. He came to David. He came and told David all that Yoav had sent him to say. The messenger said to David, "Indeed, the men were mightier than we. They went out at us into the open field. We were upon them up to the entrance to the gate. But the shooters shot down at your servants from on the wall, so that there died some of the king's servants, and also your servant Uriah the Hittite died." David said to the messenger, "Say thus to Yoav, 'Don't let this thing be evil in your eyes, for like this and like that the sword devours. Strengthen your battle against the city and destroy it, and you strengthen him.'" When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she beat the breast for her lord. But when the mourning period was past, David sent and had her brought to his house. She became his wife, and she bore him a son. Well, this is the first part of the story. I suppose you could call it the crime. It reads like a totally secular story. That is to say, it could be written in any period. At this point in the Bible, God tends not to appear to people very much. He is in the background, but he speaks usually through a prophet. There's usually some holy man who makes known to the king what the truth is, which the king doesn't always want to hear. And there is such a man at court, Natan, Nathan the prophet, who, as I said a couple of chapters earlier, was the bearer of good news that God would be with David and protect his dynasty and so on. But now something different happens. But the thing that David had done was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and the Lord sent Natan to David. You'll notice here that God's name is written as YHWH in uppercase. That is how the Hebrew text does it. There's a very old tradition that the name is not pronounced. We don't indeed know the pronunciation of the name. It's the name that you see translated as the Lord or the Eternal or something like that conventionally. And I've left it here the way it might appear in a Hebrew text. So the Lord sent Natan to David. He came to him and said to him, and of course here we're expecting rebuke, condemnation, and what do we get? There were two men in a certain town, one rich and one poor. The rich one had flocks and herds exceedingly many, while the poor one had nothing at all except for one little lamb which he had bought. He kept it alive, and it grew up with him together with his children. From his morsel it would eat, from his cup it would drink, in his bosom it would lie. It became to him like a daughter. And I give the Hebrew word here for daughter, which is bat. And there came a journey-goer to the rich man, but he thought it a pity to take from his flocks or from his herds to make something ready for the wayfarer who had come to him. So he took the poor man's lamb and made it ready for the man who had come to him. David's anger flared up against the man exceedingly. He said to Natan, "As the Lord lives, indeed a son of death is the man who does this. And for the lamb he shall pay fourfold, because he did this thing, and since he had no pity." Natan said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I myself anointed you king over Israel. I myself rescued you from the hand of Shaul," that's Saul. "I gave you the house of your Lord and the wives of your Lord into your bosom. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And as if that were too little, I would have added yet this and that to you. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in my eyes? Uriah the Hittite you have struck down by the sword. His wife you have taken for yourself as a wife. Him you have killed by means of the sword of the children of Ammon. So now the sword shall not depart from your house for the ages, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be a wife for you. Thus says the Lord, here I will raise up against your person evil from your house. I will take away your wives from before your eyes. I will give them to your fellow, and he will lie with your wives under the eyes of this son. For you, you did it in secret, but I will do this thing in front of all Israel and in front of the son." Now, I just want to break here for a second, and lest it go by too fast, you can see here that the text is indented. There are moments when this text breaks out into poetry. I don't want to get into a discussion of what makes for biblical poetry, because that's a difficult question to answer. But it's one of the only places in these kinds of texts where you get actual rhyme. I couldn't convey that in English. It would have sounded silly. So instead, I just made sure that each line ended with "your" and a noun. Your person, your house, your wives, your eyes, your fellow, your wives. The Hebrew, as I say, rhymes. It's unusual to speak that way in the Bible. So when the prophet says this, I get the impression that it's not the kind of thing that the king could walk away from. You would hear the echoes ringing in the throne room, the rhyme, the sound. So in this case, I felt compelled to try and indicate that in the in the text itself. Well, the king has been found out. We have many people in our society that are accused of various crimes. They don't usually have the response that David gives here. In Hebrew, two words: I have sinned against the Lord. I admit it, you got me. Just trying to think of some recent athletes who took a rather long time to confess their wrongdoings, for instance. Nathan said to David, "The Lord himself has transferred your sin. You will not die," which would be expected because he's implicated in murder. "Nevertheless, because you have scorned the Lord's enemies," it's really scorned the Lord, but ancient scribes were squeamish about writing that, so they stuck in the word enemies. "By doing this thing, the son who is born to you, he must die, yes, die." Nathan went back to his house. And the Lord smote the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, so that he became ill. And David besought God on behalf of the boy. David fasted a fast. Whenever he came home, he would spend the night lying upon the ground. The elders of his house arose about him to raise him up from the ground, but he was unwilling and would not take food with them. Now it was on the seventh day that the child died. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they said, "Here, while the child was alive, we spoke to him, but he did not hearken to our voice. So how can we say to him, 'The child is dead'? He might do evil." When David saw that his servants were whispering among themselves, David said to his servants, "Is the child dead?" They said, "He is dead." Then David arose from the ground. He washed, anointed himself, and changed his clothes. And he came into the house of the Lord and prostrated himself. Then he came back to his house, requested that they put food before him, and ate. His servants said to him, "What kind of thing is this that you have done? For the sake of the living child, you fasted and wept." He said, "As long as the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. For I said to myself, 'Who knows? Perhaps the Lord will be gracious to me, and the child will live.' But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I make him return again? I may go to him, but he will not return to me." And David comforted Bathsheba, his wife. He came to her and lay with her. She bore a son and called his name Shlomo, peaceful. Now the Lord loved him, and he had a message sent by the hand of Nathan the prophet. He called his name Yedidiah, beloved of the Lord, by the grace of the Lord. Now, I have ripped this story a little bit out of its context because it is set in the context of war and it goes back to battle again. But I wanted to see if I could isolate a story like this out and see if it is somehow self-referential and somewhat explainable on its own. So let me begin this last piece of what I want to do in my presentation here by asking you for words that you may have picked up on that seem to recur here. And again, there are a few of them. And this is indeed a feature of the text that's a little bit unusual. There is a lot of sending in the Bible because you have God and you have kings, and both of them use messengers. That's the currency of the time. But it is very unusual to have so much repetition here, especially on the first page of the story. Over the first, verse 3 to verse 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times, it sounds even a little bit strange in the Hebrew. Well, why stress all the sending? And again, the text doesn't tell us why it does that. We are left to figure that out. There is no "the moral of the story is" here. But why would sending be notable in this text? The thing that David had done was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and the Lord sent Nathan to David. In other words, the punishment or the rebuke is phrased in the very same terms as the crime itself. David is the man of power who pulls all the strings. He can send for women. He can send people to their death. He can send all kinds of messages, But that is countered by God through the prophet. And the prophet is preeminently the one who is sent. And this is meant to apparently counterbalance the power of the king. And of course, in the Bible, that's one of the main themes, that the king is not all-powerful as he is in Egypt or Mesopotamia, but in fact, he is under some strict rules, which if he breaks, the whole society is in jeopardy. I mean, he does seem forgiven at the end of the story. In a moment, we might say a few things about what happens after this story, which is not very pleasant. But it is true that he's beloved of God. The name David itself means beloved. And when Solomon gets this other name as he is born, Yedidiah, that also means beloved. So it's almost like reinforcing this love that God has for David. But it will be a bumpy love in the chapters that that follow. So certainly sending is one theme word that you can trace throughout. Almost every little scene in this story ends with somebody going back to a house. I don't know why that is, but maybe just a structural thing. But it starts out with the king's house, the palace. There's Uriah's house. There's God's house, which is some kind of sanctuary. And then, as you point out, there's the more figurative meaning, the house of David, the house of Israel and Judah. I mean, these chapters are a story about a dynasty that's starting. And in fact, back in chapter 7, which I mentioned before, where David is promised a perpetual dynasty, that is the other theme word there, house. I'll make your house firm, I will establish your house. So in a way, this is a kind of bitter satire, not a satire, but it's an ironic reference back to that promise and that house. Now, you know, what does this have to do with translation? Well, the minute you open this story, and I don't have another modern translation in front of me, but I can guarantee you that many of them say that David arose from his nap, you know, it was the roof of the king's palace. A perfectly reasonable translation of the house of the king. And we don't use the term the house of the king in English very much. It's the palace, of course. But the minute you do that, you have just dropped out one of this whole string of houses, and you've lost the beginning. And that's the kind of thing that I try and pay attention to, even when it's a little more awkward in English, to move the reader in that direction. The word lay or lie is, of course, all over the place. That's not a big surprise. But maybe what is a surprise is the movement. And the wonderful thing about these leading words is that they change throughout a story. As the story opens in verse 2, David is just lying around. He's taking a nap. There is some kind of fancy couch up there on the roof. This is the spring. It's even when it gets warm in Jerusalem, it's very cool around evening, and delightful to go out on the roof and or on the balcony and enjoy that wonderful air. So lying down here is merely lying down. But a few lines later, it's not so innocent. He sleeps with her. The Bible has other ways of saying this, but in this story confines it to this particular verb. And then you get shortly thereafter Uriah, who comes back from the battle and won't go home to lie down. He sleeps in the courtyard. He sleeps near the palace. David cannot get him to go home. And it really won't be resolved. You can see it in the little parable here in 12:3. The lamb in his bosom it would lie. And what is David's punishment in 12:11? I'll take away your wives and I'll give them to your fellow and he will lie with them. There's a cultural context here in ancient Israel. If the son wants to supplant the father, especially if they are politically powerful, he does that by sleeping with the father's concubines. Happens a number of times in the Bible. I don't know exactly how in the Middle Ages Jews and Christians dealt with that particular passage, but it's in the text, and it's nothing unusual in the ancient world. Well, toward the end of the story, when David is beseeching God to save his newborn child, What does he do? He fasts and he lies on the ground. He won't sleep in a bed. He sleeps on the ground. This is in 12:16. And finally, at the very end of the story, in verse 24, after the child has died, David comforted Bathsheba, his wife. He came to her and lay with her. And now the lying, the sleeping with, is legitimate and produces, in fact, the heir to the throne. And so this one word kind of weaves through the whole story and transforms itself as time goes on. So already we have sending and houses and lying, kind of a triple threat here to alert us to some of the important themes, not all of them, but certainly some of the key ones of the story. There's very often symmetry in these stories. The book of Jonah is another wonderful example, you know, two halves of a story, which are mirror images. You're right that here, you know, is he dead? Yes, he's dead. Earlier in the story, in 11:21 and thereafter, also your servant Uriah the Hittite died. 24, and also your servant Uriah the Hittite died a number of times there, or there died Uriah the Hittite. One death is meant to pay for the other. And that's a principle the Bible observes very faithfully, that somehow the punishment is supposed to fit the crime. It's supposed to be balanced. And it does that very often by means of words. In the flood story, God brings the flood because human beings have wrought ruin. They have somehow ruined the earth. And then when God says he's going to destroy the earth, he doesn't use the usual term destroy. He says, I'm going to bring ruin upon the earth. One corresponds somehow to the other. So these are some of the repetitions, but there's also allusion, not illusion. There's some of that too. But if you look for a moment at that little parable at the beginning of chapter 12, the prophet comes to David, and instead of condemning him, he launches into a little story about sheep. And we are left to wonder, what does this have to do with anything? Indeed, some modern commentators have said this is a crummy parable because it doesn't really fit the situation. What do you think? Does this work? Is this an effective parable? Should the king know that the prophet is talking about him and not about some unnamed subject out there in the boonies? Now, one aspect of this literature that I didn't touch on, and there's, of course, there are endless things to say about this story, needless to say, from ancient echoes to modern parallels. But, in fact, this text works like many other biblical texts, and you can expand its influence. Some years ago, I came across something which is supposedly called Chinese boxes. I have no idea whether they're Chinese, in fact, but it's the idea that you have a box inside a box, inside another box, and so on. You know, people sometimes give other people presents this way. It's kind of fun. In any event, I sometimes think of biblical stories this way, because once we have looked briefly at a story like this, the language resonates backwards and forwards as well. I mentioned the use of house in the earlier stories. In fact, some of the vocabulary in this story reoccurs in the very next chapter, in the horrifying tale of sometime later, David's heir to the throne, Amnon, raping his half-sister, Tamar, and he in turn is killed by his half-brother, her full-brother, Absalom. And some of the words that are in this story, like lie, and even a specific word for food, show up as if to say they are linked somehow, and that's not an accident. This story, as it turns out, even though it looks like there's been forgiveness, precipitates 7 or 8 chapters of catastrophe, with David reduced to a shadow of his former self, unable to make decisions, fleeing Jerusalem, not caring whether he gets back into power again, and having to have his counselors and generals make all the decisions. So this is the crucial point in this entire book. We're faced with a situation, as happens elsewhere in the Bible, that yes, there is resolution, yes, there is forgiveness, but the echoes continue. And we're left to ponder what kind of idea this is of fate or free will, and what our actions lead to. Buber had some kind of romantic idea of what he called breathing units. I guess it depends on how good your lungs are. You know, it's very subjective. Very often, I'm pretty close to the traditional divisions of a Hebrew text. A printed Hebrew text comes with little squiggles and signs. They're at least 1,000 years old. We don't know how much older. That tell you how to either read or chant this. And so there is something, there are things remotely like commas and semicolons and periods. So I pay attention to those, but I also read the text and try and come up with what makes sense to me. But there's nothing hard and fast about it. The text in the earliest forms we have it, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, looks like a complete run-on. There are no verse numbers. That's much later. There are no chapter numbers, and there's no punctuation. And I think it's this way with many ancient Greek texts as well. In fact, I don't think there are even word spaces. And so, you know, you can see that writing for them is merely writing it down, but not beyond that. You still have to know how to read it. You know, imagine Shakespeare without lines. Well, you'd have to do your work. You'd have to rehearse well. You'd have to make decisions. So it's somewhat arbitrary, but not completely arbitrary. But I wouldn't totally disagree with other ways of doing it. Very often I do it in a way that promotes the reading aloud of the rhythm. And that's what happens.
Dr. Everett Fox, speaking as part of the University Professors Program 2004 Literary Translation Seminar Series. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Largy and Tim Skog, with help from Boris Trapotsky. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.